One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Alrighty, folks. If you listen to this, this is Expanded Perspectives. It's been a wild and wacky week already. We're a day late and super, super sorry. We've got a guest in here with us. We had pretty much all hell break loose. I had to replace some equipment, and that's always how it is. When you're trying to impress a friend, you know, you bring them over. You're trying to, okay, we're going to impress a friend. We're going to cook a nice meal, and you burn it. So that's kind of what happened. The meal got burnt, but now we've redone it. So, this is Expanded Perspectives. I'm Cam Hale. Joining me, as always, es mi amigo, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going?
And our brother from another mutter, we brought down here, and we've got him kind of kidnapped. We've got him tied up. We cut him loose, made him do a little work. Now he's sitting over across from us, the one and only, the mouth of the South, Mr. Micah Hanks.
Glad to be here.
It's been a hell of a day, gentlemen.
It's been crazy, right?
I knew it was going to happen. I knew that was too good to be true. Everything worked out so good. And Micah got here. Everything was great. And then it just spiraled out of control. But we reined it all back together. Folks, like I said, sorry it's a little bit late, but we're going to have some fun. We're gonna talk about some cool stories. And then we're going to get into an interview we did with Warren Dara and Chris Copeland. We're going to be talking about the Thylacine Research Unit and what they're fixing to come out with. So, without any ado, I got something cool to talk about, gentlemen. We were kicking around the idea of some crypto stuff earlier in the day, and I don't know if y'all have seen this on fizz.org. Now, they're going to bring back the woolly mammoth. Actually, they're taking another step into bringing back the woolly mammoth. Apparently, there is a research team, folks, from Harvard University that's been working on this. And the team led by Mr. George Church actually said that they believe that they have a little bit more work to do before they can really write up their results, but it's looking promising. Now, Church is quick to point out that his team is not cloning the mammoth, but instead they're going to rebuild the genome of this ancient animal by studying its DNA, and then they're going to replicate it and inserting the copy of the genome into what we've all read about it as an Asian elephant. So looks like it's going to be really coming to fruition. Like, we're really going to get to see one of these things kicking around in here.
But they have to use a real Asian elephant as a surrogate mother,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So it's not really going to be 100% mammoth.
Not a pure blood. No, it's not going to be a pure blood at all. But, I mean, still, it's going to be neat. You see a woolly, I don't know how to feel about it, but I mean, it's going to be cool to see it woolly. Is this the first step? Is this the first step, you think, Micah, before they start doing any further? You mean, like, it's one thing to do like a mammoth, but is this the first step before you start talking about, or can they go back Jurassic Park style and get into the amber and pull the blood out of a mosquito?
My question will be, if this isn't going to be fully a woolly mammoth, then is it going to be like a half hairy mammoth? I mean,
yes,
yeah.
A three-quarter mammoth?
Close enough, I guess, right?
Yeah.
It'll be interesting, yeah, but I mean, this is like borderline Jurassic Park kind of stuff, yeah.
I can't, well, and what we just saw not long ago in the news was they were showing that they found a woolly rhino. I wonder if there was any way to get DNA. Of course, it looked like it was a little spoiled, like it was left in a freezer that had been unplugged and plugged back in. But I wonder if if this is the next step, if they're going to be able to start finding things like this. Because the reason I thought of this was because of the thylacine. If you could get thylacine DNA, maybe they could start
recreating those.
Start recreating that. Yeah. The dodo bird, like we've talked about, which kind of made the rounds in the news not long ago. They thought that they had some video footage of it. These are things, is it something that they could do? Or, okay, how about this? We know that they're claiming that pandas are having a hard time.
Polar bears.
Could they take their DNA right now and kind of like a seed bank, start saving it? That's what we're going to do. Then we're going to be able to clone them and help them out too. So we always got them. That's not like an AI, or you're not like you're not letting Mother Nature take its course. You're kind of intervening, but still it's a way to clone and keep them around. I mean, it seems like something that we're going to start picking on and doing.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I hope they do. I mean, you need to go to a zoo one day and be able to see these things.
I hope they do. I mean, I'm down for a woolly rhino. That'd be something cool to see.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, I mean, there are any number of other kind of options for things like this. I mean, you know, who knows what else they may end up finding. What's interesting about this, though, is that, of course, you know, the woolly mammoth being a creature which tended to exist in environments that were conducive to the preservation of that creature. Mm-hmm. That's what's going to be the most efficient aspect about in relation to trying to clone some sort of an animal, is that they're more likely to be found in a preserved state. But that reminds me of something kind of interesting. You know, I was reading the other day about a theory about Bigfoot and the reason why, of all things, footprints might appear in a lot of these upper ranges, you know, in snowy areas, for instance. You think about this, a badger, and actually a lot of different animals do this, but badgers especially, they will cover a wide area. You know, the wild in their territory. And like a lot of animals, they will tend to bury food so that they can retrieve it later in the winter months and they'll have something to eat. You know, animals that tend either to, you know, subsist upon food throughout the wintertime as an alternative to or in conjunction with hibernation tend to do this. And so, interestingly, a theory about why, for instance, Bigfoot are from time to time seen traveling to these remote, high, you know, icy peaks and things like this, i.e. Abominable Snowman reports, but also in equal measure reports of Bigfoot, you know, in parts of the North Americas, it might be that they are intelligent enough to, and actually, you know, again, I guess you could say intelligence, but since other animal species do this, you might even also say instinctive rather than intelligent. But they might bury food in the warm weather months that they can find. And people say, well, what would they eat in the wintertime? You know, it'd be almost impossible for an animal like that to survive in the cold weather months. Well, but if they do what other animals do, by virtue of a process of instinctive, you know, gathering and storing food so that they can survive and subsist in the winter months, you know, that is entirely something that I think that we, if we're to give credit to the intelligence of a bipedal creature like Bigfoot is supposed to be, it makes all the sense in the world that if other animals with less intelligence would do that, Bigfoot would no doubt do it, possibly learn to do it, and that might be one explanation for these footprints, you know, at these high altitudes and whatnot. So,
for sure.
So there are a lot of interesting things we might find in these kinds of areas that are more prone to preserve things. But, you know, that really, again, Bigfoot has very little to do with, you know, mammoths unless we find a big frozen Bigfoot body someplace. But, you know, that's happened a couple of times.
Yes, it has.
Supposedly, at least, with that Iceman, although I think that was probably a, you know, a critter in a, you know, it was a man-made critter.
Yeah.
A rubber goblin.
The one I saw was awesome, but you can't really guess by what I saw.
Well, switching to archaeology and ancient history news, did you see this from the Science News, gentlemen? This ancient ring brings Viking and Islamic civilizations closer together. Now, more than a century after its discovery, this 9th century woman's grave, they found this engraved ring on there, and the evidence suggests that there was close contacts between both the Vikings of Scandinavia and the Islamic world. Now, excavators of a Viking trading center in Sweden called the Birka recovered this silk. They are called the Birka. They recovered the silver ring in the late 1800s, but until now it was thought that it featured a violet amethyst engraved with Arabic-looking characters. But upon closer inspection with this new scanning electron microscope, it revealed that it has an inscription that reads "For Allah" or "To Allah," which is, you know, it's suggesting that there was a trade organization between the two cultures.
Which is not surprising. It's really not. Everybody wants to act like, well, I say everybody, that's what mainstream wants us to believe a lot of. We talk about this a lot on the show, is they want you to believe that nobody can communicated, nobody traded. Everybody was just like, oh, I didn't know anybody lived on that side of the hill. Now you're finding out, guess what? There's another one. Yeah, they were.
That's exactly right. I mean, everybody knows that the Scandinavians and the Vikings were seagoing people, and they were the world travelers, I believe. And this just shows that they were, in fact, trading with Islamic nations far earlier than anyone gave them credit for.
Well, it makes, I still, like I said, I think they did a lot of trading here. I think in North America there was a lot of the trading going on, and we found some things. But it's funny that it seems like what we've always said. It keeps getting pushed further and further back, and then you find out there was more and more people involved in it, like what you just talked about. I think we're painting the picture, and it's going to be how much longer can it go before they have to go? Yeah, when I say they, we're talking about what modern academia is teaching the kids today. How much more can they fight back? How much more can you, you can only hold a wall up for so long when there's enough people pushing on the other side that you can't hold it anymore. It's like the floodgates. How long can you keep your finger in the hole of that dam before it finally breaks?
Yeah, and what's really cool is it shows that they say that this ring shows virtually no sign of wear at all, and that you can still see filing marks that were made during the final stages of its final production.
That's awesome.
And that suggests that the Arabic silversmith that made this, that there was probably no other owners other than the Viking woman that they found it on.
Gosh, it's beautiful, too. I mean, just look at the thing.
Right? It's incredible how old it is.
Could you imagine if you were the person who dug that thing up or found it? I mean, gosh. And that's the thing is that, otherwise, things like this maybe are being kept, in private collections all over the world, passed down, from family to family, generation to generation. Who knows how much evidence of these kinds of exchanges maybe have come upon, or actually still exist but are kept in private collections and whatnot around the world. It's just a matter of knowing what to look for, I guess, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
Yeah. So, well, okay, so here's a little something, and again, changing gears a bit. I've been following this mystery boom stuff a lot, guys. And so as a guest on the show, I don't know how much you guys talk about this. I know there's been a lot of chatter about the mystery booms.
We did a story not too long ago about some in Davenport, Idaho, I believe. Or Iowa, I'm sorry.
Yeah, right? Iowa.
They really seem to be, there's been a concentration around the middle of, the Midwestern United States. Kansas, Idaho, it's been really interesting, and a lot of different ideas about what's been going on. But now my buddy Paul Seaburn over at Mysterious Universe had done a piece about this, and this one caught my eye because here I am visiting Texas with you guys, just having left North Carolina. Supposedly there was a report of a mystery boom around the Outer Banks on March 16th, right before I left apparently. And what they're talking about is that there were local officials, among them, members of the U.S. Geological Survey who'd spoken about this, who said that there was no earthquake activity that was detected, nothing seismic or otherwise. The USGS admitted that it was at a loss to explain the booms and asked for any and all input on its website. Right now, I don't know that there have been any updates about this, but what's really interesting is that in conjunction with these booms that were reported earlier this month, what is also being described is the fact that there were numerous fish that began to start dying. Reports of thousands of dead fish and a dead dolphin even washing up on the beaches near Corolla, North Carolina, on the Outer Banks. The area of the beach covered with dead fish eventually reached 3 miles in length.
Ooh.
But the booms were actually heard all up and down the east coast of the United States. So, we'd heard a lot earlier this year, of course, and late last year, talking about the mystery booms that were being heard over London. They were heard over the northeast United States. Then we were hearing about them mostly in the Midwestern United States. Everybody was saying cryoseisms or frost quakes, but often, and interestingly, there are any number of sites that archive weather data for, up to a month to, sometimes years, going back. And you can look at the weather for any locale, and often there were instances where what you might call the epicenter of the so-called mystery booms, there were not significantly cold enough temperatures, not even below freezing, that would have been conducive to ground freezing following a rain that would have caused that freezing and then that sudden cracking that's associated with the cryoseisms that occur so much in the winter months. And this is really interesting because here we are, especially throughout the southeast where, it's early spring down here. It's beautiful weather. And yet now on the Outer Banks of North Carolina, we're seeing reports of mystery booms and then fish dying. Now, there are a lot of things that can cause a fish to die. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the specialists who are looking at this right now with the U.S., I think actually we've got the NC Department of Environment and Natural Resources, but we also had some Division of Water Sources and environmentalist experts who were commenting on this. And they were talking about the fact that these particular fish, known as moss bunkers, oily fish that are caught primarily as animal feed, and they're also used as fish oil supplements, I should note. These guys can tend to be extremely sensitive to things. Kind of like, when you have, goldfish, or actually goldfish are extremely hardy, but certain other kinds of, tropical fish, you put them in a fish tank, the slightest change mm-hmm. and they can die. And these particular fish are known to be extremely sensitive to environmental changes. So it may not be something directly correlative, I should say, with these mystery booms. But, you got to wonder, because we have not, to my knowledge, come to any kind of a consensus about what is causing these things. And there've been, I've heard everything from over-the-horizon technologies being developed, sonic booms from mystery aircraft, to other kinds of things. People have even tried to say fracking. And I, as far as I understand, really there's no conclusive scientific connection between the fracking, between the cryosseisms, especially if we're seeing warmer weather temperatures in the southeast and we're nonetheless still seeing the mystery booms. Who knows what's actually causing these things? You know, for some reason, if I had to follow my gut, I might think, again, you know, just guessing here, that it's still something meteorological in phenomena. And while it's a phenomena that people say is probably more often to occur than is being reported until recently with all the interest in it, it's still something that I think that a lot of people probably are trying to find answers for. It may be natural, but we don't know.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I wish there was more info that we could actually put our finger on it. But, and I don't know that we ever will. I don't know that we're ever going to find out what that really is. And it could be, maybe it's not black and white. Maybe it's not just one thing that does it. There could be multiple things that are causing it. But I don't want to hear it. I don't, man. I can't, like I told you, and we had discussed it on the show. I mean, there's certain types of construction that you can hear it when the weather's right and there's a way things are reverberating off of low-hanging clouds and things like that. It will freak you out. When you hear that, you're like, where is that coming from? And you start hearing like what you're talking about, and then you start seeing fish wash up. The first thing you think is they're together. It's a whole group thing. What the hell's going on? It makes me think of the movie The Seventh Seal. Remember that? Whenever he walks in, and the dude breaks the seal and throws it, and all the fish come washing up. That's what it makes me think of right there. Well, folks, like I said, sorry for the show being out so late. Hope you've enjoyed a little bit of this right now. We are fixing to jump off into our interview with the Thylacine Research Unit. Now, it's made up of three fellas, and we got Bill Flowers, of course, Chris Copeland, and Warren Darren. Now, we only had Chris and Waz on, and nobody really knows. They got into a little of it. They couldn't talk about everything we wanted to talk about, but just so there's a quick heads up, this is the first time it's been discussed anywhere in the U.S., what you're fixing to hear, their show, they are filming a show, and it's going to come to air soon. They're going to let us know when it is so we can let everybody know, but it's going to air first, I believe, on Animal Planet or Discovery, or both, basically. But it's going to start in the U.K. and Australia, and it's going to be them showing all their research into the thylacine and basically them looking for it. So they're going to get in and talk a little bit more about the thylacine and kind of also the... You kind of get an inside without giving away too much of the processes that they go through in order to find this thing and then how scientific they actually approach it. It's not, I don't want to point fingers at anybody, but it's not setting off fireworks and putting a disco ball in the trees and beating on a tree and making howls. It's a little bit more scientific than that. So it was a great interview. Those guys, they really are. They're like our brothers from down under, man.
Absolutely, yeah.
So much fun. They're great dudes, so... Stick around. We hope you enjoy it, and we'll catch you on the back end. This is Expanded Perspectives.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand-new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.
All right, everybody, we are bringing it back with some old friends of ours. Started with us pretty much back when we started, and we got some really, really cool info coming from the land down under, from our brothers down there, Mr. Chris and Warren of the Thylacine Research Unit. Fellas, how's it going?
Good, mate. Real well. Thank you.
Good to be on the show again, guys.
You guys have been up to some fun since, of course, what everybody doesn't really know is we talk to these guys, what, it's almost like once a week. We're sending messages back and forth and busting on each other and sending memes back and forth to each other. And it's not, it's madness. It's nonstop madness of comments on each other's stuff. It's something that we, like we said, we've talked about it back and forth, and we've not said anything to anybody, and we finally got it where y'all can come on and talk about it. And what folks don't know, let's bring it back up. First of all, we had Warren on the first time. Chris was busy riding his bobber around Tasmania and Australia and all that stuff, you know, just living the life. So, Chris, introduce yourself to everybody and let everybody know what it is that you do, and then we'll have y'all talk about what it is that y'all do together.
Hey, guys. My name is Chris. Founded the Thylacine Research Unit with Warren and Bill. I work with Tasmanian devils and quolls. I sort of do a bit of tour guiding and some research and that sort of biz. Beside that, as you said, I like to ride my motorcycles, and I've just graduated into American Muscle, so I'm got my first breakdown this morning.
Right. Yeah. And you gotta be going back and working. What did you say was the clutch?
Yeah, clutch. But you get nothing beats the sound of it.
No, that's true. There's nothing beats the sound of a Harley. It just, I can't help it. I get drawn into it. And then Waz, he's our friendly Australian black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu that likes to hang out and chat with us. And but y'all have been really working your tails off. Now, for those of you that don't know, give them a quick breakdown, Waz, of what the thylacine is.
So the thylacine is believed to be an extinct animal. So it was in its time the largest marsupial carnivore. So it looks essentially like a dog or a wolf with stripes, but it's more closely related to other marsupials like the kangaroo, for example, the Tasmanian devil and the quoll. So it's a case of evolution basically making this animal look very much like the dog or a wolf. And it's a real animal that the last known animal died in a Tasmanian zoo in 1936. You can go into museums all over the world and see taxidermy specimens of the thylacine, or the Tasmanian tiger as it's commonly referred to. So what the Thylacine Research Unit does is it goes out there and it tries to prove once and for all whether the thylacine is extinct or whether we can find evidence that there is a remnant population out there somewhere.
And I'm hoping that there is. It's one of those things that I didn't know a lot about it till we got to talking to you guys and had you on and all that the first time. And it grows on you. I mean, it's one of the, I like the stories of Bigfoot and all that, but the thylacine has grown on me like crazy now.
Yeah, because it once was a real animal. So, you know, why couldn't it still exist? You know, maybe a very small population, but you know, there are actual sightings from time to time, and even on your website, thylacineresearchunit.org, you have some sightings on there, and it's pretty interesting, and even have an area where people can submit their own sightings. Are there any cool sightings that you could talk to us about today?
Just before we talk about that, I think it's just important to bring up that, like with the Bigfoot case that you're talking about, you're trying to prove the existence of a new genus of animal, which hasn't been done for a long time. Mm-hmm. Here we're sort of looking for evidence for a real species. You're trying to shift the goalposts of timeline to when it was gone to extinction or whether it's still extant, rather than sort of trying to prove the existence of a new genus of ape or something like that. And I think from there, it suddenly means that it's one of the cryptids that are most likely to be rediscovered if it's still out there.
Sure.
Yeah, so absolutely. And because of that, you know, you have, I guess, a wealth of evidence that you can actually go back and data and have a look at. You. So you can see these animals in museums. You can see what their foot structure looks like, you know, what their footprints would be. There's hair samples that you could use to test against to say this is or isn't a thylacine, while all of that, you know, doesn't exist for a Bigfoot, for example.
So you've got, yeah, pretty much all the proof that you need to kind of hold up whatever sightings and whatever physical evidence that you might find in the field against it to see what you can kind of balance it.
so recent that they've even got film footage of it. The only thing that they don't have is an audio recording of thylacine, because film back in those days didn't have audio. So it's so recent that we can actually look at the thylacine walking its gait, its morphology, its sort of gape when it opens its mouth. It's an extraordinarily recent thing.
Yeah, you can go on YouTube and things like that. You're right. You can watch videos of them, and they're black and white films. But yeah, you can see them. I mean, it's a really cool looking animal too. I hope that they are in fact extant.
Absolutely. And I think with Tasmania, you've got sort of a landmass that's about 68,000 square k, so it's sort of bigger than some of your US states, but it's only got 510,000 people. So half of those at least are in the main city, Hobart. So the rest of the state is quite wild and quite wilderness orientated, and that means it's still got a fair bit of space.
Yeah, plenty of habitat out there, and I think anybody who's done any even mild sort of bushwalking in Tasmania will tell you that you could be on a walking track, and you know, 10 meters off the track, you could have, you know, a herd of animals and not even know. So there's plenty of opportunity for an elusive shy animal to hide.
You're exactly right, and that's what people, lots of times they kind of forget that, is they think that we're so advanced as a civilization now that we know everything, and all the little woods and all the brushes, underbrush has been cleared out, and everywhere you go is like a beautiful park, and that's just not necessarily what's going on, really.
Yeah, absolutely, and Tasmania, it's probably really only extensively been explored for minerals. Other than that, there's probably places that people haven't gone for generations, if ever, and that makes it an extraordinary place to live and an extraordinary place to search for a cryptid.
Well, with that out of the way, why don't y'all tell them what you got into? Because it's kind of one of those things that everybody, that when they start investigating, they don't think of this at first, and then luck kind of swung y'all's way and some people took notice of what you were doing.
I guess we had been putting together a whole heap of thylacine-related videos, basically trying to create a digital record of the work that that we do at the experiments that we do in the field. We put them up on YouTube. We get comments from people, and we evolve our techniques as we go. So as a part of that, we had the idea to enter one of the Tasmanian screen festivals, and where we basically put together a collection of videos of ourselves, where we actually pitched the idea for a TV show, and we met with a mate of ours who had some very high-end video equipment. We went out in the field and we did the things that we did best in terms of setting up a few sort of experiments, and we put together a 5-minute film or a promo for this particular film festival and awards, and whilst we didn't actually win it, we got the People's Choice Award, and as a result of that, Chris was approached by a producer who had an offer that was too good for us to refuse, and I guess Chris can lead off from there.
After I drank my carton of beer that I won for the People's Choice.
Well, hang on, you didn't tell me about that.
Sorry, mate, you wouldn't have liked it. It was 4X or something like nothing.
Okay.
From there, I went to lunch with these guys, and they sort of decided that they'd been talking to a company in Queensland, and together they wanted to co-produce a documentary about thylacine and wanted us to be involved, and we sort of were fairly keen, and we fleshed out a few of the ideas, and bottom line is that we've just come back from making 2 1-hour specials for Monster Week that are going to air on Discovery.
That is amazing. I mean, it's one of those things that it's I'm excited for you guys, and I'm also excited for where it's going to take the research, where there's a possibility to open it up to other people, where everybody else is that may not know what a thylacine is, and even people listening now that may have not even heard of the term. Now it's something that they're a lot, now I wouldn't say everybody just yet, but there's a chance it's fixing to evolve to where everyone will be able to see this and kind of get on board. It had to be something that caught y'all off guard to be approached like that.
Yeah, absolutely caught me off guard. Like, we always sort of had it in our heads that it'd be cool to make just an indie little film, hence the promo and the pitching competition, but to sort of be approached by not one but two sort of professional production houses coming together to want to produce this, absolutely awesome. And the guys that we worked with, some pretty well-respected guys in the field, which was absolutely awesome experience.
Now, I know you can't go into detail about the documentary or things on the documentary, but can you give the listeners an idea of when you guys go out into the field to conduct this research, like, what are you doing out there? Like, how are you trying to track this this possible creature down? Like, what kind of experiments are you performing? Are you setting traps? Are you just using sound and audio? You have game cameras, I know. What types of things do you do when you're in the field, when you're going and doing these investigations?
I think
initially,
the first thing,
you go, Warren. I was gonna sort of just introduce the idea of the 3H idea, but you go, absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess Chris and I are both on the same wavelength there. I think before we step into the field, we actually do a whole heap of desk and computer based research, because there's no point. We're looking for a needle in a haystack, so we need to make sure that the places that we're actually looking are the places that have got the highest probability of actually having a thylacine in it. So we developed, I guess, the three H's, which start. The first one is, I guess, and you know, I guess we play around with the order with this from time to time, but basically we start with, it has to be good thylacine habitat. So thylacines like a particular type of habitat. But the main thing is it's got to support, you know, thylacine prey. They need to have a place where there are abundant prey species for them to feed upon. Then the next thing that we look about is the history, and in particular the pre-1936 history of thylacines and documentary evidence of thylacines in these particular areas. And one of the best ways to do that is to look at what bounties were taken. So from the late 1880s up until about 1909, there was a Tasmanian government bounty on thylacines. So the landowners would actually get paid quite a sizable sum in those days to actually bring in a dead thylacine. And so a lot of those locations are actually recorded. So we can actually see where they were. And then the last thing that we look at is a good history of post-1936 sightings. So after the animal was believed to be extinct, have people reported sightings in that area? So what we then do is we get all of that data, we throw it into Google Earth, and lo and behold, patterns start to jump out. So particularly when you rate the sightings in order of sort of credibility. So we would then sort of go out to these areas where they're basically hot spots, right habitat, right history, recent sightings, and then we would start using our bag of tricks, and it's including
things like... Can I just jump in for a sec, boss?
Yep.
Just before you talk about that, I think it'd be great for you to sort of mention the fact that we can rate these sightings. We've got the Smith system, and we can rate those sightings, and then we go out.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and I guess a lot of the stuff that we're talking about now is the game-changing approach that TRU brings to the table. And it's one of the reasons why people like Discovery and Animal Planet take us seriously, because, you know, whilst a lot of our videos were lighthearted, we actually are pretty competent at the things that we do. So the Smith system, basically in 1980, the World Wildlife Federation actually sponsored a team of people to go out and to find evidence for the thylacine. So it was one of the largest searches in history post extinction. And as a result of that, they said that they had all of these hundreds and hundreds of sightings, and they needed to be able to categorize them in terms of how legitimate they were. So it was things like, where was it? What time of day was it? What was the duration? What was the altitude? What was the mode of transport? What was the credibility of the witness? You know, are they someone who is familiar with Tasmanian wildlife, all of those sorts of things. So that ends up having a quantitative measure of how good a particular sighting is, and it gives you a rating from 0 to 50. So what that then allows us to do is you sit there and say, you know, there are sightings where clearly they look dubious, you know, and despite the person, you know, may very be well being honest, but they saw it for half a second and, you know, all they saw was, you know, a dog-like creature running across the road. Well, the balance of probabilities would say that you saw a dog, right? So that would score lower, as opposed to someone who is, you know, a respected wildlife observer who observed the animal for 30 seconds and can describe in detail what they saw. Well, that would score higher. So that means that you'd be far more likely to follow up a sighting of that scale as opposed to the other one. So it also allows you to do that. So what we've then done is we've gotten all of that sighting information and, wait for it, we've put it into a spreadsheet, drives Chris spare, but it allows us to accurately sort of assess where we should be spending our time, and that way you're just not wandering around in, you know, in the bush getting lost and wasting your time. So that's the general approach that we take, and that's the thing that's unique, and I think that's the it's that desk-based data approach that allows us to be really effective when we get into the field.
The fact that I pay Warren's spreadsheets out, it doesn't sort of detract from the fact that it is a remarkable thing that he's managed to put together, and we get clusters. We can scale all the sightings into sort of one quantitative lineup, and that on the maps. It sort of allows us to sort of determine whether this is something completely left field or whether this is something that we want to sink our somewhat limited resources into to go and investigate. And he has done an extraordinary job in getting hundreds and hundreds of sightings from a whole bunch of different sort of resources, both public and private, and bringing it all together to make this database.
Mm. And I think the other thing that once we then get into the field, like, you know, we're not the only thylacine hunters out there, if you like, but with the skills of people like Chris and Bill, we can be out in the field and, you know, there'll be teams who, you know, I guess best intentioned and trying to do the right thing. They'll be stopping, they'll be gathering evidence for things like scat, so basically fecal matter that animals leave behind, that they might then say, okay, well, we think this is large and it might be thylacine related, let's send this back to the lab. You know, Chris and Bill will look at it for about, you know, 30 seconds and say, this is what this animal is and this is the order it arrived to the carcass in which it was feeding on, move on. So they've got that skill of being able to identify, you know, just the way that that Tasmanian animals behave, that means that everything that is normal or normalish in the Tasmanian bush, they can understand. So it allows you to focus on those things that are atypical. So hang on, this looks a little bit different and we should be spending more time investigating this particular thing. So it makes it more likely that you get a hit rather than investigating sort of random stuff.
Yeah, okay. So once you guys have gone through these computations and built these spreadsheets, and if you located a few hotspots and you decide, the three of you, when you're going to go or where you're going to go, take us into what you guys do on the ground, on the street, you know, when you get out there in the field. What does a typical investigation look like?
So daylight hours, there's not a lot of point, in our opinion, of looking for the actual animal itself, because like most marsupials, evidence suggests that it's night or dawn-dusk active rather than middle of day active. So we tend to get out there and get the lie of the land, and then we will investigate for scats, dens, hair samples during the day, and then we use our sort of quiver of toys at night to try and sort of determine whether the actual animal itself is still out there.
So it's one of those things, too, that, as you were talking about the cameras, is that seems like that's what it's kind of turning to now, is you can cover so much more area now that you have a lot of this more technology, I guess, kind of at your fingertips, that seem to make it a lot easier on you.
The technology, the game trail cameras, they're just absolutely game-changing. And realistically, regardless of how elusive a species is, if it's there and you've got enough cameras out, then in theory you're going to get it. And it's revolutionized wildlife research right around the world. And even in Tasmania, you might be aware that devils have succumbed pretty heavily to devil facial tumor disease, and there's been an 85% loss. They use these game trail cameras constantly to research devils because they're so elusive and cryptic. And I mean, it's just natural to want to use that technology that's available to us to search for thylacine.
Now, of course, without opening up the lid, we don't want to discuss anything that we're not supposed to discuss. Have you seen some interesting things? Has the cameras helped you find some interesting things this last few times? I would take that as a yes. We will be glad to move forward. You said something about the devils. What were you talking about? What's wrong? What kind of disease do the devils have now?
So the devils devils used to be very common. Even 20 years ago, devils were a very common animal, and they've collapsed in number through something called devil facial tumor disease, which is a transmissible cancer, and they're talking 85% loss statewide in under 20 years. So they've become relatively rare, and sort of it's really had an impact on what is the second order carnivore. So in Tasmania, we've lost the thylacine and a significant number of Tasmanian devils as well, and the whole island's changing because of it.
So in another 40 or 50 years, somebody could be doing this, looking for actually looking for the devils again.
There's still a chance that devils could go to extinction, absolutely. And the sort of the knowledge that we've built up of devil and myself and Bill, because we've worked with devils for a long time, it really does sort of put us in good stead to sort of look for the other marsupial carnivore in the form of thylacine. We sort of know what the vocalizations are that devils are capable of and things like that. And it sort of puts us in good stead to sort of look for the cryptid marsupial carnivore.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask is some of the stuff that y'all have probably gotten, you can also pass on to everyone that's wanting to help out with the devils as well.
Yeah, there's been sort of in the past, there's been thought that, sort of foxes may have established in Tasmania and all those sorts of things, and that would have been an ecological nightmare. And so when we've laid cameras, we've always been on the lookout for the number of feral animals that are present in an area. And also we do get devils on our cameras, and it enables us to see what number of devils there are, what their population sort of is like, what the age dynamics like, and from there it also gives us a chance to take a stab at whether the area can practically support a top order predator. It sort of allows us to take all that computation that we spoke about before and put it into practice. If you've got a reasonable number of devils, then there's obviously enough prey and resource to support a top order predator.
Well, and was, because I have no idea, and was the number of devils up there in numbers as far as many of them in the woods at the time that the thylacine was still out there too?
There's some debate here. Like the devil numbers collapsed at about the same time because the same bounty. And a lot of people forget that not only the thylacine but the devils were under the government bounty. So their numbers collapsed. But the sort of without the competition of a large predator, their numbers recovered and stabilized and exploded. And sort of by the time we get to the mid-1990s, there was probably more devils in Tasmania than we'd ever seen before.
Okay. Now, for our listeners, now the thylacine, what made them become extinct? Did they succumb to a disease too, or were they just hunted by farmers and stuff, you know, preying on their livestock, or is it just sport hunting, or what led to their demise?
So I guess there's a couple of contributing factors to that. So during, I guess, the late 1800s, there was quite a significant push from the landholders in Tasmania to introduce a bounty scheme because of the misguided belief that the thylacine was actually out there killing their sheep. And what I guess history has taught us is that whilst the occasional sheep may have been taken by a thylacine, there are probably lots of other things that were killing sheep, particularly wild dogs, stray dogs, even the dogs that the farmers themselves are using. Plus, there was a whole heap of just general mismanagement of those farms. So what was happening is a lot of those companies that were, you know, had their headquarters back in the UK were getting reports from their managers back in Tasmania that this savage tiger was going through and clearing out, you know, vast quantities of sheep. So it was really an excuse for mismanagement. So we then had the bounty scheme that was introduced, and there were about 2,200 bounties that were paid over a 29-year period. At the same time, you had some habitat loss and a distemper-like disease that that took hold amongst the population. So you then you've got a number of factors that are all combining to spell the doom of the thylacine in that particular time.
Okay. Now, Chris, is it known of the thylacine? Was it a social animal? In other words, did they keep together in packs, or was it a very solitary animal, or do they even know that?
This is, again, it's debated, but none of the other marsupials show any social orientation. Devils are a little bit unique because their range overlaps. So devil's a solitary animal, but it's not territorial. Their ranges overlap with one another, and if one devil kills, another can try and steal it, or you can get convergence of Tasmania devil on a carcass where they've all smelt it and have come in and sort of carry on and sort of try and tear apart, dismember it. But most of the evidence suggests that the thylacine was a solitary animal, and some of the sightings that have been made of a number of thylacines together could possibly be mother and offspring rather than sort of pack or clan structure as people imagine it.
Right.
So I'd say if most of the marsupial carnivores throughout fossil record and modern are solitary, we've got to assume that the thylacine's solitary. And that's probably why it was driven to extinction in other parts of Australia, because when dingoes arrived from Asia about 4,500 years ago, it just couldn't compete against their social hunting ability.
Now, is there a large population of dingoes still in Tasmania?
Tasmania is unique as an Australian state because the dingo never arrived here, and that's why when Europeans arrived, you still had Tasmania devil and you still had populations of the thylacine, because we're talking about 15,000-odd years for Tasmania to be separated. So it was a peninsula, but at the end of the last ice age, sea levels rose significantly enough to lock Tasmania off and create an island, and it became a haven for quite a number of species that have ended up going to extinction in other parts of Australia because of things like dingo. So if dingoes only arrived 4,500 years, they basically just couldn't get to the island of Tasmania, and that's why we're here today, because we're capable of talking about things like devils that went to extinction in other parts of the country pre-European.
Okay. Well, what is the government's official stance on the thylacine? In other words, if you guys are able to prove that they exist and they are discovered, however small this population is, do they plan on protecting the species?
So the thylacine is a wholly protected animal, and it has been since, I think, June 1936, about 3 months before the last one died in the zoo. It got fully protected status. So if a thylacine was discovered tomorrow and conclusive evidence was proven, it would be fully protected. And you know, if you did anything to interfere with that particular animal, then you'd be liable to legal prosecution. So in fact, this is something that has come up on a number of occasions where I guess other tiger hunting teams have been out there and they've proposed to use sort of pitfall traps in order to capture a live one to provide that conclusive evidence. And they've applied for licenses or permission to do that, and they've been denied that because of the fact that, you know, if the animal was actually out there and if it did fall into one of these traps, well, then it could be potentially injured and interfered with, and therefore you'd be liable for prosecution. So I think that there is quite a hefty body of legislation that actually protects these animals if at the event that they are rediscovered.
Now, with all the sightings that have been reported to you and Chris and Bill, are there any sightings outside of the state of Tasmania?
No, there's a lot, and I'll pass to Warren to talk about this because he's got a tremendous amount of those sightings on his spreadsheets. But, I mean, it never ceases to amaze me, guys, exactly how many thylacine sightings you get from outside Tasmania. And, I mean, they're talking maybe 1,000-plus years since thylacine walked the mainland, as we in Tasmania call the rest of the country, because we're an island state, so we refer to the rest of the continent as the mainland. The bottom line is that, and we don't drink Foster's, boys.
Oh, come on now, Chris.
We've seen the commercials.
The commercials. That and Outback Steakhouse.
Yeah, and I'll throw a baked bean can at your head. There are definitely sightings. There's probably at times more thylacine sightings from outside Tasmania, from Western Australia, South Australia, and certain parts of Victoria and New South Wales, and even Queensland. And it never ceases to surprise me. Sorry, Warren.
Yeah, so Chris is 100% right. There are actually more thylacine sightings from the mainland in comparison to those that are made in Tasmania. And there's a raft of potential reasons for that. So there are people who subscribe to the theory that there was a clandestine group of individuals who, fearing the demise of the thylacine, introduced a number of breeding pairs into Victoria, which is the mainland southernmost sort of state in the early 1900s, and let them loose. And what people are seeing are the descendants of those animals. There's also a theory that not all of the thylacines were wiped out by the dingoes or the competition with the dingoes, and that there is a remnant population that is in some of these states. So there are continued people who are out there looking for these. I guess the issue with mainland sightings is there's potentially more animals that that can be confused in terms of, you do have dingoes, you've got also a fox population in mainland Australia that we wouldn't expect to see in Tasmania. But I guess I'm somewhat more sceptical about the mainland sightings than I am the Tasmanian ones. And part of the reason for that is abundance of prey. I think when people go to Tasmania, it is like a completely different part of the world in comparison to mainland Australia, just in the density of prey. So there's far more prey for an animal like the thylacine to be able to get, you know, its hands on, for want of a better term, than in comparison to parts of mainland Australia. I guess the other argument is that, and something that I guess the diehard skeptics have used for a long time, is that the quality of the sightings in the mainland actually detracts from the quality of the sightings in Tasmania. So essentially what they're saying is that, you know, people are clearly mistaken. They're not seeing thylacines in the mainland, and therefore, because they are purporting to see them on the mainland, then the ones that are happening in Tasmania are equally unlikely. So, but you know, I guess there are a core group of thylacine believers out there who believe that they are remnant in both Tasmania and the mainland. There is some documentary evidence that suggests that they're in the early 1800s, some European scientists may have dissected mainland thylacines. But if that's the case, they must have very quickly gone extinct thereafter. So there's been a few books on that subject as well that are written by credible authors.
Okay. Well, if people want to help out and support the Thylacine Research Unit, you guys have an Adopt a Trail Cam program. Can you tell people about that, if they want to jump on board and donate and help you guys out?
Yeah, absolutely. So if we have a number of people from all parts of the world who actually sponsor the activities that we have, and one of the most practical ways to do that is for them to sponsor one of the trail cameras. So on our website, we have an Adopt-A-Cam link where people can go in, and there's a couple of different grades where they can choose which type of camera that they actually want to support. And then what we do is we then name that camera after them. In fact, some people have named it after their grandkids, and you know they we shoot a short video thanking them for their donation, and then we also mention the camera's name when we actually place it out in the field to say, this is the Canon Kyle camera, for example, or the expanded perspectives camera, and here it is over this particular game trail. We've placed it in this particular So I guess that provides people a really close link to the research that we're doing, and I guess the hope of everyone is it's your camera, the one that you've sponsored, that actually finds that conclusive evidence. And you know, I think we need lots and lots of cameras out there because it's a big sort of location that we're searching. And, you know, the cameras practically really only cover, say, a 10 square meter location. And the other thing we like to do is we like to have the same area of interest captured on two cameras. So because the video experts tell us that with, you know, photoshopping technology these days, that, you know, it's relatively straightforward to fake an image from one angle, but two angles concurrently is a much harder deal. So it makes it much more likely that if you actually do capture a thylacine in the area, if you've got it on two cameras at the same time, you present that forward, it's far harder to actually argue with that evidence. And at the same time, you're not in any way interfering with the animal. And I guess that's the other sort of fundamental tenet that we have with all of our research, is that we're out there to protect and preserve, not to, you know, pursue and prosecute. So we're trying to do this in a way that doesn't impact on the environment, doesn't impact on the animal. We've got the animal's best interest at heart. It's about making sure that if it is out there, that it gets the protection that it properly deserves. We learn from the mistake of the past where, you know, we took it to the brink of extinction.
Yeah, and that's really cool that you offer that. I think that's really neat to give the people the ability to sponsor you guys by adopting a camera. Now, come on, people, get out there and support the TRU. And, you know, like you mentioned before, there are several other research units and groups of thylacine hunters out there. But I like the way you guys approach it. You seem to be very serious about it, and that's what I like about your research the best. I can't wait to see this documentary that you guys have done. Cam?
Yeah, what else can you tell them about the documentary? Where are they going to be able to see it? Do you have any idea when they're going to be able to see it?
This point, it appears that it's going to air in the UK first, and then it will air in Australia, and I'm not actually sure, but after that.
Yeah, so I guess the way that we understand it is that the world is sort of divided into different regions from Discovery's perspective. So depending on the popularity of the show, it then may be picked up by the US sort of audiences and then shown there. But I guess we're expecting sort of in the next couple of months it'll start to be released. As Chris said, we've done all of the shooting and a lot of the editing has now been completed, so it should be on the airways very soon.
Well, whenever you find out of exactly when it's going to be up, let us know. That way we can let all the listeners know, everybody over there in England that listens. That way they can jump on it, and all the Australian listeners can jump on it. And then we can get feedback from them, and then we can start like a Facebook page or something to make sure they get it over here so we can get a look at it.
That'd be awesome. Absolutely. Really appreciate that.
Yeah, we got to make sure. I got to see this.
Absolutely.
I'm going to be pissed if I don't get to see it.
Yeah. I can't wait. I think they're going to find something. Now, if anybody has a sighting of their own, your website, I guess, is the best place to make that report?
First Contact. Yep.
Yeah, so we have a sighting report section on our website, and basically it leads people through the process of providing the information that we need to be able to assess the sighting report. And I think that this is one of the potential positives of, you know, having an international documentary that's going to be beamed to, you know, potentially millions of people. It's going to provide a much greater focus to the animal, but also those people who potentially haven't provided their sighting information, regardless of how old it is, because it all can go into our spreadsheets and our databases and build up a better picture. They can then say, okay, these guys are collecting this information, because the data that I have suggests that only about 1/3 of sightings actually get reported. So if you assume that there's been 400 sightings in Tasmania over the last 70 years, well, the real number's closer to 1,200. So if we actually ended up getting all of those additional 800 sighting details as a result of, you know, our show reaching, you know, a million people worldwide, and a lot of these sightings are by tourists who come into Tasmania, a lot of people visit Tasmania, then that then adds to our database and allows us to refine, to triangulate where we should be looking even more.
Just on that, I think it's also important, like, you're now looking at 70 years. Some of those people that saw the thylacine, like, in its early days, and saw sort of the thylacine about the time it went to extinction, they're getting fairly old, and it'd be awesome to get that data down before, tragically, they end up passing, and the information and the sort of the documentation of the maybe the sounds that it makes or its behavior goes with them.
That I just appreciate all the work you guys have done, man.
Absolutely.
I'm so glad it's paying off for y'all. I'm so glad it's kind of getting more noticed, and this is one of those things. I hope it's there. I hope you find some information. I want it to be there. I said it last time, I say it this time, I want it to still be there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I guess so do we. But I guess we're skeptics, where we think that, you know, the balance of probabilities is that, you know, it's probably not there.
Mm-hmm.
But in order for us to be taken seriously by the scientific community, we have to have a scientific methodology and proper hypotheses to go out there and not cry wolf at every time we sort of see something that's interesting. So I think that at times, I guess, might mean that some people don't agree with, you know, we're saying, well, we think it's extinct, when and they think that it's out there, but, you know, there's no evidence that it's out there, for example. So we need to be able to provide that proof that will stand up through academic peer review, that, you know, a government official could come in, a university professor can come in and have a look at the data that we've collected and validate it and say, yes, that is thylacine DNA on that hair, or that is a thylacine footprint, or that video is categorically, you know, thylacine, and it's been tested that, you know, it hasn't been faked or altered in any way. So that's why we go through the rigor of the processes that we do.
Well, and that's the only way to approach it, to be, like you said, to be taken seriously. That's the work you've got to put in. Guys, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and chat with us and tell everybody about it. And we will make sure, as soon as you let us know, we'll let everybody else know where they can watch it. Folks, go out there, support them, get you a camera. Maybe your camera will be the one that they actually get the pictures off of that shows a thylacine. Chris, Waz, thank you guys so much.
No worries. I'd just like to take the opportunity to thank you guys for the support you've given us from the start, and also your listeners. So thanks very much for the time that you've given us today.
Yeah, and anybody who isn't listening to Expanded Perspectives Elite, subscribe. It's a great show. I listen to it. It's fantastic.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Pretty cool. I love talking to those two guys. They're always into trouble and stuff. And I really like the way they approach investigating the thylacine. I think that they're real. I think that they still exist. I don't think it's an extinct species. I think it may be a small pocket of them, but I do think it's extant. I believe, you know, so much of Tasmania is wild and just unsettled that I love to daydream that they could still be there, you know, lurking around in the forest, you know.
I'm 100% with you. What's funny is the first time we've talked to Waz on air, and then we've talked to him a bunch off air and things like that, is he's very... Him and Chris both are very scientific on, they're fun loving guys like all of us are. But when it really comes down to where you're like, this is, I got to hang my hat on a nail and this nail has to be what I'm putting my reputation on. It's the fun loving stuff goes out the window and they get very, very specific. And we've discussed things. They don't go out saying it's there at all. They just go looking for the information and reading what it gives you. I think they're like us. They want it to be there, but I don't know that they hold out the hope that it's really going to be there. You know, they, you know what I mean? It's
yeah, like, I know what you mean.
And I know, like I said, I want it to be there, and I'm with Kyle, but I don't know that I believe as much as you do, because I think it might have used to have been there, but I'm afraid that it's, I don't think it died in 36 like everybody says, but I don't know that it's still there now. I think that some of the sightings from the 70s and maybe 80s, something like that, might have still been there, but I don't know if it's there
anymore.
And
there may not be enough breeding pairs, yeah. You know? But I always bring up the fact that I spent a lot of my life in the woods being a hunter, and I've never seen a mountain lion, but I know they're there.
That's true.
I've never seen one.
That's true.
I mean, you see their pug mark sometimes. You know, I'm talking like maybe 3 times in my entire life, but I've never seen them.
I've heard them scream.
So if that animal that is known and pretty popular is thriving in the area that we live in, but no one ever sees them, something that's very elusive and maybe a small population, I'd like to at least think that it could exist.
Well, and like you and I have talked about, we know that there's bobcats everywhere. And you talk to a lot of people, and a lot of people have never seen them. Even spend time in the woods. I mean, I've spent a ton. I've probably only seen 4.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, like I said, you can argue either way in the whole thing. I want it to be there, but I don't know. I don't kind of think that it's not, but I think I'm more thinking that it's not because I want it to be a good surprise. You know what I mean? It's,
yeah.
It's like, I don't want to think that I got an awesome video game for Christmas until I open it up and I got it. So,
yeah. Well, if you're interested in the thylacine and all the work to do, please go over to their website. I'll put it in the show notes, but it's thylacineresearchunit.org. You can go in there and see sighting reports. They got some videos on there, them doing some investigations. And also, if you're interested in supporting them, you can adopt some of those game cameras to help them out.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
That's pretty cool. What else is going on? I know we have Micah Hanks in studio with us today. I'm glad that he was able to come down. We're going to do some field investigations this week, so that's going to be pretty fun.
Some fun doing that. So we got some good stuff we get to discuss on Thursday. We'll probably be discussing what we found. We'll probably get into a little Lake Worth monster info. We'll probably get into the Aurora cemetery crash info, and then we'll probably do a little more stuff on the Stephenville lights. So I mean, we'll have some stuff coming up for the Thursday for the Elite show, and some stuff coming up for the Monday show. We'll have a bunch of stuff to talk about in the next week. Also, folks, keep an eye on Facebook, keep an eye on Instagram. Things, we'll be posting pictures of all of our misadventures, if you will.
That's right. And if let me know what you think about the thylacine, if you think it's extinct or extant.
Yes.
You can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. And don't forget, if you really enjoy Expanded Perspectives, you can always rate and review the show on iTunes. And if you're really a big fan, then you can always sign up for Expanded Perspectives Elite. You can go over to the website, expandedperspectives.com, click on the top right. And while we got him here in studio, in case you're living under a rock, you guys should listen to the Grayling Report.
Yeah, if you haven't heard it, shame on you.
Right. And he also offers an extra show, too, Grayling X.
Yes.
My favorite ones are the Crypto X. because he gets in depth with about the cryptozoology, and I love to hear things like that. What's new that's going on over there at the Grayling Report, Micah?
You know, I couldn't tell you. I don't listen to the Grayling Report. I produce that show, but I do subscribe to Expanded Perspectives. I know we're studying cryptozoological marvels like the Eskimo curlew. No doubt you guys know this creature, right?
No,
I never heard of this.
No idea.
Of course, most people don't. And here's the whole point about it. You know, people discount these ideas of the so-called sightings of thylacines and whatnot in modern times. But you know, the curlew is a bird believed to, if not be extinct, at very least critically endangered. There have been no official sightings, I don't think, since the 1960s. But there was what was described as a reliable report by bird watchers that involved about 23 birds that were seen in Texas right here in 1981, and then there have been subsequent sightings in 87, 1990, and these all over the world. I mean, I think that the 87 sighting was in Canada, Argentina in 1990, even as recently as 2006 in Nova Scotia. I bring this up because, again, this is an animal that is believed to be extinct, and yet there are still sightings of this creature, and nobody knows, you know, what the Eskimo curlew even is, and it's just like a little bird. It looks kind of like a snipe, really. And I'll tell you this, that such inconspicuous members of the fauna in our natural world, may still exist. They may go unnoticed, and mostly they go unnoticed despite having even existed in recent times. It's not beyond the stretch of the imagination to me that an animal believed to be extinct might actually be critically endangered, and that there are still surviving members of that species. And so I remain hopeful with thylacine, and it's really inspiring to hear these kind of stories, guys.
All right, everybody, have a good week. Don't work too hard. Make sure you stay safe. If you're a member of Elite, we will be speaking to you on Thursday. For everybody else, we'll see you next Monday, Cam.
That's right. We'll have it out on time, we promise. This time we won't. Well, I can't say we won't. We might spill water on it. Who knows? But I mean, just a bad deal. So sorry, folks. But yeah, when we always tell everybody to give each other a hug, give us a hug. This has been a rough day. So all right, folks, y'all take it easy. We'll talk to you later. Peace.
Luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Chumba. Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.